I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. It's always a bit daunting to sit across from a novelist and summarize their new book in a few short sentences, especially when that novelist is Salman Rushdie, but I'll give it a shot. His new novel, The Golden House, is about the wealthy Golden family, the patriarch, who calls himself Nero, and his three sons, who go by the names Petronius, Lucius, Apuleius, and Dionysus. They've emigrated to a fancy part of Manhattan from India, hoping to leave their past and their secrets behind. A young filmmaker, you can call me Renee, is intrigued by the family and gets drawn into their dark and dangerous world. The story begins with the inauguration of Barack Obama and ends 8 years later when someone named the Joker becomes the president. Salman Rushdie has lived in Manhattan since 2000, recently became an American citizen, and joins us once again on Radio Times. A great pleasure. Nice to have you back with
Hi.
Us good on the show.
Yeah, very good to be back.
Nice to have you back. I'd love to have you begin from the very beginning of your new book.
Okay, so this is page one.
There you go.
On the day of the new president's inauguration, when we worried that he might be murdered as he walked hand in hand with his exceptional wife among the cheering crowds, and when so many of us were close to economic ruin in the aftermath of the bursting of the mortgage bubble, and when Isis was still an Egyptian mother goddess, an uncrowned 70-something king from a faraway country arrived in New York City with his three motherless sons to take possession of the palace of his exile, behaving as if nothing was wrong with the country or the world or his own story. He began to rule over his neighborhood like a benevolent emperor, although in spite of his charming smile and his skill at playing his 1745 Guadagnini violin, he exuded a heavy, cheap odor, the unmistakable smell of crass, despotic danger, the kind of scent that warned us, look out for this guy, because he could order your execution at any moment if you're wearing a displeasing shirt, for example, or if he wants to sleep with your wife. The next 8 years, the years of the 44th president, were also the years of the increasingly erratic and alarming reign over us of the man who called himself Nero Golden, who wasn't really a king, and at the end of whose time there was a large and, metaphorically speaking, apocalyptic fire.
That's our guest, Salman Rushdie, reading from the very beginning of his new book, The Golden House. So where to start here? There's a lot that you packed into that paragraph, including this guy named Nero Golden, who does play a violin. We know that the original Nero fiddled while Rome burned. Why did you name him Nero? Or why did he name himself Nero?
Well, he has rather grand ideas about himself, you know, and I think to call yourself Nero Golden tells you something about what you think of yourself. I mean, for me, it happened that actually there weren't any fiddles in ancient Rome. If he played anything, it was probably the lyre.
Oh.
I once, when I was, I mean, several years ago when I was visiting Rome, I was taken into the buried palace of the Emperor Nero, which is actually called the Golden House, the Domus Aurea. And is now underground because it was literally buried by his people who followed, the emperors who followed him, who didn't like him. And it's very evocative and grand. So I thought that's where the Golden House came from. You know, so that's how he got his name. He's a dark figure. But one of the things I think happens in the novel is that as the novel progresses, you become more compassionate towards him. You know, that he, when you meet him, as in that paragraph and the pages that follow, he seems pretty scary.
Yeah.
You know, but I think, you know, as you find out his story and as what happens in the novel happens, I think you become more affectionate towards him almost.
His sons, who he has named themselves or renamed themselves, Petronius, Lucius, Apuleius, and Dionysus, why those names for you?
Well, Petronius because of the Satyricon, I suppose. Also because, you know, one of the main character in the Satyricon, Trimalchio, is something that has something to do with Gatsby. You know, and that's to say, you know, Scott Fitzgerald wanted to call the novel Trimalchio in West Egg before he came up with The Great Gatsby. So he was also somewhat inspired by the lavish parties, you know, of the Satyricon, which Gatsby also throws. So, I mean, I was thinking a bit about Gatsby because, you know, Gatsby's name is not Gatsby.
You know, he changes his name.
Yeah, he's called Gatz. You know, he comes to New York, and he reinvents himself completely, in his case, for love. Nero and his family's reinvention is for darker reasons of trying to escape a shady past. But the theme of reinvention, of identity, of changing your identity, and so on, is obviously completely at the heart of the book.
Well, I was thinking also that when you were in hiding, the name you used for yourself was Joseph Anton, so you renamed yourself.
Yeah, I hated it.
But you did it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, for a bit, and then I killed him.
And then you killed him. But nonetheless, for a time, you had another name.
I had to use an alias,
for yourself. Yeah. But you also write, people in America were called all sorts of things throughout the phone book in the days when there were phone books. Nomenclature, exoticism, ruled, Huckleberry, Dimmesdale, Ichabod, Ahab, Fenimore, Portnoy, Drudge. Is there something about Americans and changing their names, reinventing themselves?
Well, I mean, it's one of the great, you know, tropes of American literature is people come to America and change. You know, whether it's being given a name at Ellis Island or simply simplifying or altering your name to make it easier for local consumption. You know, I mean, famously, Samuel Goldwyn's original name was Samuel Goldfish.
It wouldn't have worked so well.
Metro Goldfish Mayor. It wouldn't have been so good.
Well, and also the Trump name was Drumpf.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, it's quite normal. And in this case, what's not normal, most of those people are coming as migrants to just, you know, to make better lives for their families and so on. In this case, this is a very wealthy family. I mean, these are not people looking to make a buck, you know, and they've got sacks of gold, you know, but they are running away from something, or at least Nero is. And the something he's running away from has also the potential to endanger his family. So he goes to these enormously elaborate lengths to start again. And I guess the tragedy of the novel, which is pretty inevitable, mm-hmm. is that it's not going to work.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
It's going to blow up in his face.
Also about fathers and sons, how fathers want to protect their children or their sons from their past.
Yes. I mean, I think that fathers and sons is a very big theme in this book. And I think that's, in a way, the way in which the reader begins to have fondness for Nero, because mm-hmm. in spite of everything he's done in his life, much of which is not at all worthy, as a father and as somebody dealing with his children, he is actually much mm-hmm. more admirable, much more likable.
Does that say something about you?
Well, I mean, I'm very, you know, I mean, I have two sons, and I think we're, the three of us, very close, you know, and it's very important for me to be a good parent as far as I can be. You know, my father and I had a bumpy ride because he was a wonderful father of small children and a less wonderful father of children who developed minds of their own. So there's a sort of middle period which was rocky, and then we've sort of made it up later on. But my view is, if you should at least learn from your parents' mistakes, and if you're going to make mistakes, make different mistakes.
And we all seem to do that, exactly. As a parent myself.
Exactly.
Tell us about Renee. This is the filmmaker who is essentially the narrator.
I mean, one of the things I really, you know, to me, he's actually my favorite character in the book because he developed in very unexpected ways. For a start, the one thing I knew is that I wanted a first-person narrator, and I wanted him to be somebody much younger than me. And it's the first time in my life I've had a narrator who's not of, like, South Asian origin.
You know? Oh, interesting.
So, I mean, to have a kind of white, born and bred New Yorker as a narrator, and for him to be in his 20s, you know, that was a kind of challenge, and I kind of liked that, to try and inhabit this next generation, you know. And then he became much less passive than I had originally thought. I thought he would be the on the edge of the story, observing the Golden family, and as he finds out about them, we find out about him. So he'd be like our representative in the book. But he wanted to get involved.
He wanted more than that.
Yeah,
he wanted to be a participant.
Yes, and so there's a crucial moment in the book when he crosses that boundary between the observer and the participant, and he gets very, very entangled. And since he has all kinds of moral criticisms of the Golden family, I mean, then he does something which is pretty easy to criticize morally as well. So he has to face that in himself.
Sure, sure. And some of this novel is a screenplay, I would say. And I know you have written screenplays, or you wrote one at least.
Yeah, I wrote one that got made. I wrote the screenplay for the film of Midnight's Children.
Right, right.
I mean, I have written one or two others that didn't get made.
And that apparently happens a lot. But there are a lot of film references in here. And I wonder, even as a writer, whether you think like a filmmaker.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, what is true is that I've been obsessed with movies all my life. You know, I think if you grow up in, as I did in Bombay, now Mumbai, it's impossible not to be obsessed with movies because the entire city is obsessed with movies. Right. And so you grow up with film in your blood, kind of, you know. And then when I was at college in England, I mean, I would go to movies all the time. And I've always wanted to use that material somehow. And because René is a young filmmaker, I was able to give him a lot of my film nerdery and let him use it to explain what's going on.
Film nerdery, I like that. This is something you wrote in The New Yorker, 1992, out of Kansas, about, the song Over the Rainbow, but just The Wizard of Oz being a classic outsider immigrant story?
Yeah, I mean, I love The Wizard of Oz. I mean, it's a story about people, you know, with somebody coming to a strange world and having to make her way. And it's a story about a world in which you can't trust the adults. You know, that all the adults are weak. You know, Aunt Em and Uncle Henry can't help save the dog. The wizard is a fraud, you know. And so, you know, she has to learn to rely on herself, Dorothy. And one of the things I'm most proud of about that essay I wrote, which appeared in The New Yorker, is that I got a fan letter from a munchkin. I got a fan letter
from a real munchkin?
Yeah, from the munchkin coroner. You know, she's not only really dead, she's really most sincerely dead.
Oh, that's such a great line, of course.
And he was very elderly and living in a retirement home in Florida, and he sent me a nice note.
What did he say?
He said he liked my essay and that he did a very funny thing. He sent me a color Xerox of his big scene on the steps of the Munchkin Town Hall, holding up the scroll which says Certificate of Death. And underneath, he's filled in my name.
He killed you?
So I have a Munchkin death certificate.
Well, on that note, let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation with Salman Rushdie. His new novel is called The Golden House. We've been talking about some of the characters and some of the thinking that went into that novel. We're going to talk about some other things as well, the fact that he became a U.S. citizen just a couple of years ago. He's lived in Manhattan since 2000, in fact, has lived in cities pretty much his whole life. He mentioned the word Bombay, which is often called Mumbai, and I do want to talk about that as well. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Salman Rushdie, author of more than a dozen novels. In fact, his new one is his 13th novel. And his Midnight's Children won the Booker Prize. And he has also written nonfiction, essay collections, and children's books as well. You mentioned Bombay, which is now called Mumbai. There's also, you sort of struggle with the word Myanmar, Burma in the book as well. Are you being contrarian?
I mean, probably, but I think you'd find if you were in Bombay that there's a lot of people that still say Bombay. You know, it may be a generational thing. It may be that, you know, that as the generations move on, that the new name will just naturally catch on. But it's in a way like saying Saigon and not saying Ho Chi Minh City.
Ah, you know, right.
I mean, one name feels genuine and the other one feels not.
So Bombay feels...
feels real.
Feels real.
Yeah.
Feels
because
real.
Because the reason it's called Bombay is because when the Portuguese, who were the original colonists of that part of India, when they were there, they named it after the harbor, which they called it Bombaia, which means the beautiful bay. And Bombaia became Bombay. Mumbai is just what it's called in the Marathi language, and that's now been imposed on the city in a way that I find, you know, unfortunate.
There is a Mrs. Golden. I mean, she's a bit of a mysterious character, obviously, in this novel as well. But she's in the Grand Hotel in Mumbai, which was attacked by
Lashkar-e-Toyba.
Yes. Yeah. And people were killed.
Including in the novel her. Yes.
Including her. What did that mean to you, I guess?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, that was one of the real genesis points of this book, because, like anyone whose hometown that is, that was a kind of very important, horrifying moment. You know, it was the kind of 9/11 of Bombay, you know, I looked into it a lot. I mean, I dug around in it a lot, and I think the moment in the novel which talks about that is, I mean, I have to say, it's very deeply researched, so it's as accurate as I could make it. And one of the things that really interested me was the apparent collusion between the terrorists coming from Pakistan and the local Bombay crime mafia, you know, so that became a part of where the novel started. I wanted to explore that.
Is this novel also, because it begins with the inauguration of Barack Obama, ends with the election of this guy called the Joker, who we will talk about, but is it also about the forces happening sort of under the ground or in this country that led from the first black president to
the
white one, but also the one who was the most ardent birther in the country?
Yes. Other than the story of the Golden family, which I had developing in my head for several years, really ever since that attack in Bombay, you know, other than that, I had the real desire to write, in a way, the opposite novel to the one I wrote before, which is also a novel about New York, but is a kind of fairy tale of New York. You know, it has genies and flying carpets and stuff. And I thought, don't do that again. You've taken that as far as it can go. Try and write a real social novel. Try and write a sort of social panorama of what's been happening in New York and in America in the last decade. You know, and I prepared by reading a lot of writers who did that kind of thing, by reading Edith Wharton and Henry James and so on. And above all, I think, by reading Charles Dickens, because what I love in Dickens is that he has this whole social world, you know, the background of his books, in incredible detail. Incredible, accurate social detail, and then he projects on them these characters who are sort of larger than life, you know, and we love the characters and we believe them because they are so deeply rooted in the real world, you know. So I thought that's a good way to do it. So yes, one part of this novel tries to absorb and talk about sort of everything that's been on people's minds in the last 8 or 9 years, you know, and Occupy Wall Street. I mean, all sorts of things. And then when the election campaign started, which was while I was writing the book, I thought, well, given how it developed, I thought it would be absurd to not mention this. You know, I mean, it would be, you know,
right.
It would be just like, you know, if it's the elephant in the room and you've got to, in the end, take it on. And it's the only bit of the novel in which I divert a little bit from the realistic, because I invented this cartoon villain,
yes,
you know,
the Joker.
And it's sort of a joke, the Joker, because in the deck of cards, the two playing cards that don't behave properly are the Joker and the Trump. You know, and I thought they're the two cards.
I did not make that connection.
And I thought, well, I don't want the Trump, so I'll have the Joker.
You also, in this, and I'm going to have you read a section from this, but also talk about the bubbles. I mean, and we all, excuse me, live in our own bubbles of our own creation, and the two realities that seem to coexist.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, René is very idealistic.
This is the filmmaker.
He's a very idealistic young man as a narrator, and he's very anguished about what's happening in his country, you know, and he, at various points in the novel, he goes off on little rants, you know, about what's going on. And one of the things that really concerns him is these incredibly deep divisions that are growing up, divisions in people's understanding of reality, you know, in what's true and what's false, what's real and what's not. And he fears, you know, for America, I think.
I want to have you read another section. I just switched this out for you. This is where you see those little, and we're passing the book back and forth here, down near the bottom.
Yeah. Well, this is one of his riffs, you know.
This is about the bubbles.
Yeah, a year of two bubbles. In one of those bubbles, the Joker shrieked to the laugh track crowds, laughed right on cue. In that bubble, the climate was not changing and the end of the Arctic ice cap was just a new real estate opportunity. In that bubble, gun murderers were exercising their constitutional rights, but the parents of murdered children were un-American. In that bubble, if its inhabitants were victorious, the president of the neighboring country to the south, which was sending rapists and killers to America, would be forced to pay for a wall dividing the two nations to keep the killers and rapists south of the border where they belonged, and crime would end, and the country's enemies would be defeated instantly and overwhelmingly, and mass deportations would be a good thing, and women reporters would be seen to be unreliable because they had blood coming out of their whatevers, and the parents of dead war heroes would be revealed to be working for radical Islam, and international treaties would not have to be honored, and Russia would be a friend, and that would have nothing whatsoever to do with the Russian oligarchs propping up the Joker's shady enterprises. And the meanings of things would change. Multiple bankruptcies would be understood to prove great business expertise, and 3,500 lawsuits against you would be understood to prove business acumen, and stiffing your contractors would prove your tough guy business attitude, and a crooked university would prove your commitment to education.
You're talking about Trump there.
Yes, I am. Oh, he is.
Well, he is, meaning your character, yes. Renee. Mm. Did you feel like you were breaking character by including
no,
that?
No, I mean, I just thought, okay, I'm going to go for it. You know, I mean, like, this is what's happening in the country, and I don't want to pussyfoot around it. Apologies for the use of the word pussy, which is a presidential term now.
apparently a presidential term. But is this your cri de coeur?
It is somewhat. You know, I mean, I think I feel horrified by what's been let out of the bag, you know, as a result of the election and the dark forces, you know, that we saw in Charlottesville and elsewhere. And what worries me is that even if Mr. Trump were to dematerialize tomorrow and disappear, you know, these forces will not easily be put back in the bottle, you know, and I think that that's going to be something that we have to deal with somehow in the years to come.
You have a sentence here, the America I loved, gone with the wind.
Well, he's worrying that that's...
And this is Renee
that
worrying.
Renee, the narrator, is worried... He's, you know, and he uses, of course, a film reference because he's a film nut. But he's worried that that may happen, that that what he has always thought of as America, you know, might be replaced by another idea of America, which he doesn't feel at all close to.
Do you feel, though, that you, I mean, you write about the two bubbles, and as I said, we all live in our bubbles, but that the one bubble didn't understand the other bubble?
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, that's absolutely the case, and that needs to change. Yeah.
That's Salman Rushdie, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, and he is a novelist, a writer. He's written a number of books, and he's got a new one. It's called The Golden House. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Ashley from Wilmington, Delaware, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Ashley. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much, Marty, for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Rush, I just wanted to say I really was first introduced to your work at age 7. My father bought me a copy of Haroon and the Sea of Stories for Christmas that year, and my mother used to read it to me. He passed shortly after me getting that purchase, and I read it years and years and years, and then finally I was able to share that story now with my children. So I just am really here, like, kind of geeking out to be able to talk to you.
And, I mean, that's so nice, you know, because the story of that novel, Haroon and the Sea of Stories, is one of the things I'm fondest of in my career, because what the story you've just told of reading it when you were little and then reading it to your children, I hear that story a lot, and it's very, very moving to me that the book moves through the generations like that, you know. It's one of the great things about books for younger readers is that they can do that.
And Ashley, you can always geek out on Radio Times, just so you know.
Yes.
Thanks a lot for calling into the show. There's a museum of identity in this novel, and identity seems to play a a pretty large role in this story.
Yeah, I made up the Museum of Identity. I'm rather proud of it.
It's coming.
Yeah, I feel that somebody's going to start one, you know, any day now.
Hopefully they'll trademark it
I think I need to. But it's just because the theme of identity, as I said, with the Golden Family trying to change their identity, etc., is right at the heart of the novel. But identity means so many different things now, and people are so agitated about it in a lot of different areas. You know, I think in America, probably those arguments are around the two subjects of race and gender. You know, and in the novel, I try and take this on because one of the characters, one of the sons of Nero, is very conflicted about his gender identity. You know, and so that was a way for me to get into that subject. You know, elsewhere in the world, it's different because in India, which is, you know, this novel is in a way, it's a kind of tale of two cities because even though most of it is in New York, the kind of backstory that makes sense of it is across the world in Mumbai. And in India now, when you talk about identity, it's not so much about gender or race, it's more about religion. It's more about kind of Hindu-Muslim conflict. So the word means many different things in different places, and I just wanted to explore all of that.
Renee's parents are professors, and at one point he says about them, they worried that young people were becoming pro-censorship, pro-banning things, pro-restrictions. How did that happen, they asked me. The narrowing of the youthful American mind were beginning to fear the young. Do you see that happening?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I run around American universities quite a lot. You know, I teach at NYU, but I also lecture in other places. And we talk about it when I meet members of the faculty elsewhere. One of the things that they say is that this is an undergraduate problem, not a graduate problem.
Oh, you know, so these are young students.
So it may just be a part of growing up. You know, I mean, by the time they become grad students, that this is not how they think. You know, and I mean, in my experience of teaching, because I mean, at NYU, I really only teach grad students at the moment. None of these issues have ever raised their head. That these issues of, you know, trigger warning and safe spaces and so on. It is happening, and it's happening with very young people. And I just think it is worrying that groups of very well-meaning and often very idealistic young people are, for reasons of idealism, willing to suppress expressions of thoughts which they don't like, you know, and it seems to me one of the things that is crucial to university life is that you must be exposed to thinking that you don't agree with, you know, so it is a worry. I'm not sure that it's a really colossal worry because, as I say, it seems to me people grow out of it.
We're an interesting country in that we have this First Amendment. Not all countries do, and so we get to say sometimes terrible, hateful things.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've had to rethink my views about this because in England, there's a thing called the Race Relations Act, which actually makes it a crime to say things which are racially inflammatory, you know, and you could go to jail. You know? And for a long time living in England, I thought, I don't see what's wrong with that. Right. You know, it seems fine to me.
Right.
You know. And then I came here and began to learn about how the First Amendment defines where the First Amendment draws the line, it's a much broader definition, which actually does protect that kind of speech. And I came around to thinking that maybe that's better because actually, A, you don't get rid of terrible ideas by forbidding their expression. And sometimes you make them more powerful because you give them the glamour of taboo, you know, and I want to know where those people are. I'd sooner know where those people are than have them hiding under a carpet somewhere.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions was at Georgetown recently talking exactly about this. I'm not sure if he's exactly the right messenger for this particular message, but I did see a picture of, and he was allowed to talk. People did protest, but I did see a picture of people sitting in the audience with tape over their mouths. Do you think is the way to say, I don't agree with you, I don't believe you?
I mean, protest is absolutely fine. You know, and a completely
allowed protest,
a perfectly necessary and normal part of student activity. You know, but protest that prohibits speech is then you're becoming a censor. Then you're becoming the thing that needs to be protested about. You know, people taping their mouths over it, fine. It's a gesture, you know, and it's a legitimate and powerful gesture, fine.
But what do you do about Milo Yiannopoulos?
Well, you know, the point is, in that episode, it was really a stunt. You know, I mean, he kept saying that he was calling all these people. None of them were coming, you know.
Including Ann Coulter, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, if he was really just pulling a stunt. Actually, Berkeley had gone to great lengths to make possible expression of all kinds of competing views, and were preparing to spend something like $1 million on security to make it possible, you know. So the Milo thing was just him showboating, you know, and I have very little sympathy for that.
Have people protested your speaking on a campus?
Never, no.
Never?
No.
Does that surprise you?
No.
Disappoint you?
Nope. Nope.
I
like it. You know, that's what I'm saying, that my experience of the American campus is that it's not at all as endangered a space, you know, as some of this coverage makes it seem.
Which I guess you can always pull out a couple of incidents or examples.
There are incidents and examples, and I think they need to be discussed and so on. But, you know, I'm not sure that this is taking over the world quite yet. And as I said, the kids who do this 2 years later don't think like it.
Interesting. Salman Rushdie, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, author of now 13 novels, the new one called The Golden House. His Midnight's Children won the Booker Prize. Of course, he wrote the Satanic Verses many, many years ago, The Ground Beneath Her Feet, and he's also written nonfiction books as well. We are talking about writing, some of the ideas in this book, talking, of course, about politics as well. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Salman Rushdie. And back before he became a famous writer, he worked for an ad agency called Ogilvy & Mather. This was back in the 1980s, and came up with this slogan.
Just look at that. Light as a feather and trembling with naughtiness. Of course, the trouble with me is I never could say no.
Fresh cream cakes. Naughty.
But nice.
Naughty but nice. The words of Salman Rushdie many, many years ago.
I'm so impressed. That's like written in 1979 or something. I'm amazed you found it.
Well, you know, there is this internet. We can find most anything. How did working for an ad agency, though, help you as a writer?
Well, first of all, it paid the rent while I was writing Midnight's Children.
Interesting.
I mean, Midnight's Children took me 5 years to write, and I needed money. And so in those days, you could do something which you can't do now, which is you could get part-time jobs in advertising. So I had a job where I was working like 2-3 days a week, and that gave me between 4 and 5 days a week to write. You know, so that's what it mainly did for me. But it did teach me things. It taught me, for instance, not to be precious about inspiration. You know, I mean, when you're in advertising and the client is coming in on Thursday at 2 p.m., you know, you've got to be ready, and it's got to be good, and that's just it. Sit down, do your work. You know, and
like Mad Men, right?
Yeah, and that's very good discipline. It's very good. And ever since then, I've had the attitude to writing, which is you just sit down every day and do your job. That's it. You know, no fussing around. Don't allow yourself to have writer's block. You know, I mean, I set myself a number of words a day, and I don't get up till I've written them.
Right. You know, and whether you like them or not,
I do it. I just do the day's work. You know, and so it taught me that. It also gave me the opportunity to work with a lot of amazing filmmakers. You know, because in those days, in the '70s, a lot of people who became this golden generation of British filmmakers were all like making beef burger commercials.
Oh, you know? So
like Ridley Scott, Tony Scott, Hugh Hudson, Nicholas Roeg, you know, all these really, and they're more actually extraordinary filmmakers who were doing what I was doing, which is kind of freelancing, moonlighting in advertising, making a bit of money for themselves while they set up movie projects. You know, so I made a hair care commercial with Nicholas Roeg,
I wonder where that one is. We'll have to dig around and see if we can find it. Yeah. And Naughty But Nice, were you proud of that?
Well, you know what is strange about it is that, I liked it because I thought it was funny. And when we pitched it, the client said, didn't like it, and said, you're telling people that cream cakes make them fat. And I said, well, they know that. I said, you should focus on the But Nice. And, it took a long time for them to agree to it, but then it became famous, yeah.
Well, let me get some more callers in on the conversation. Looks like we've got Joe, and Joe calling us from Philadelphia. Joe, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
It's a pleasure to be able to speak to you, Marty, and to you, Mr. Rushdie, who I've been reading for years. I was wondering, kind of, a lot of your writing is political, and obviously this Joker character echoes Trump, but I remember also Jaguar Smile and then when Daniel Ortega got reelected. I wonder, kind of, do you look for or hope that someone will notice you and pick a fight with you? Like, is that catnip for writers that just gets everyone's attention, or you kind of try to avoid that and stay out of that spotlight?
I mean, I don't really. The truth is, neither one nor the other. I'm just trying to say what I have to say, and I've got no interest in really having people pick fights with me. It's happened slightly too often. And I'm quite happy that, for example, this novel has come out and has not yet elicited a tweet from the 45th president.
Oh, interesting. I wonder if he reads novels.
I'm not sure that he's a big reader, but I'm sure he has people who read for him. I'm just trying to say here's my take on things, and then what happens, happens.
Right. We went to your Twitter account because we tweet out our guests and contact them. Your last tweet was dated November 8th, 2016, and it says, done, you're welcome.
Yeah, I just voted for Hillary. And then what happened. I had been thinking of stopping Twitter anyway. And that just sort of clinched it. I just thought, okay, I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. And it's because when I started, I was told by a friend I should try it because I'd enjoy it. And so I tried it. I did enjoy it. I liked having the direct contact with readers and having fun with people in a kind of lighthearted way. And then I don't know exactly what happened. I think either I changed or it changed. I'm not sure my sense is that Twitter has become more bad-tempered. That there's a lot more, trolling and kind of like lynch mobbery, and I just thought, I don't like this tone of voice. I don't like that, and I'd rather be not in this conversation. So I just stopped.
Was it that you didn't like you in Twitter, or you didn't like the people who were tweeting at you?
No, it wasn't really about, because in my case, I didn't have that much of trolling or whatever, but just the general atmosphere of the place, if you like. I just thought, I don't like this. I don't want to be in this room. And so I stopped. There are some writer friends of mine who were always teasing me or critical of me for having become involved. People like Jonathan Franzen and Martin Amis would say, we can't understand why Salman does this, because they're very
beneath you.
They're very anti social media. And for a long time I thought, well, you make your decision, I'll make mine. But I've actually come around to thinking more or less as they think, which is that it's a noise I don't need in my head, And I stopped, and I haven't missed it, So it was interesting for a while. I mean, I did it for 4 or 5 years, and I had, it was very flattering to have like 1.25 million people.
I was going to say, I bet you had a lot of followers.
Yeah, 1.25 million is a lot until you start thinking about the people who actually have a lot.
Right.
I mean, even amongst writers, people like Neil Gaiman and Stephen Fry have like multiple millions of people. And then when you get to the real lords of Twitter, Justin Bieber and Donald Trump and Kim Kardashian, then you feel
you're a loser.
You feel humbled by your mere 1.25 million. But it was fun. It was fun while it lasted. But I'm glad I gave it a shot.
Joe, thanks for your call to Radio Times. And you can call us as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. I know that you've described this book as a return to realism for you. But reading it, I'm just curious about your head, your brain, because it seems there's pop culture, there's literature, there's Greek mythology, there are events that happened in India, there's a sort of not roiling, that isn't exactly the right word, but there's just a lot of stuff going on there.
No, this is, I'm sorry to tell you, this is just the nonsense in my head.
Is it?
This is how it comes out. And what I genuinely think about writing is that there are really two ways of writing good books. One is to take a very shining single strand out of the world and to write that, and I think there are writers, Jane Austen, W.G. Zabel, there are writers who do that wonderfully well. And the other thing is to try and write these everything books, you know, what Henry James called loose baggy monsters. And I think this is much closer to the everything book. You know, it tries to get in a lot of what has been happening, and to allow the characters to move through that world which we have all been moving through, you know, for the last 9 or 10 years. And I think if you do that right, then readers now have the pleasure of recognition. They have the pleasure of reading the book and saying, "Yeah, this is what it's like," you know, or what it's been like. And then hopefully in the future, readers looking at the book would be able to recapture the sense of what it had been like. You know, that's if you get it right. If you get it wrong, then the book loses value almost immediately in the way of yesterday's newspapers. You know, so, I mean, I have to hope that I got it right.
Are you a tough critic of your own work?
Yes, I'm super tough. Yeah, I mean, I think that's almost the most important weapon in a writer's arsenal. You know, you have to be able to know when it's no good. You know, because if you don't know when it's bad, you don't know when it's good. So, yes, I mean, and everyone I know who is a serious writer is extremely tough on themselves.
I just was looking at a comment here. How does he pronounce his name? How do you pronounce your name?
Salman Rushdie.
Okay. Do people mispronounce it?
Yes, Salman Rushdie.
Oh, Salman, which is probably what I said.
No, you said Rushdie.
I said Rushdie. Okay. Okay, good enough. You became an American citizen a couple of years ago, 2 years ago.
Just under, yeah.
I guess the obvious question is why, but even beyond that, what did that mean to you?
Well, you know, why is because, I've been living in America for 19 years, something like that, you know, and I had a green card forever, and I just got frustrated at not having full membership, you know, and in the two Obama elections, not being able to vote, I felt very weird about that, you know. And I thought, you know, I'm not leaving. This is where I live, and if this is where I live, then I should belong fully, you know. So then I went into the whole process, I got to vote in the last election, and look how well that went.
Well, welcome to America. But I read a description where you described the kind of simplicity of the words, but why that meant so much to you.
Yeah, I mean, it was very interesting, I thought, when you go downtown in New York to swear the oath, the words of the oath, are they're not poetic, you know? I mean, it's quite...
What are they?
Well, you have to do a lot of swearing to join the army if you're called on. and confusion to our enemies and so on, but it's what I'm saying is it's quite plain English, you know, and yet it has great power because of the affirmation that you're making, which is a very important one, and it actually reminded me somewhat of the marriage service, you know, which where again the words are quite straightforward, you know, but the declaration you're making is so powerful that it has a very powerful effect, you know. And so I was quite moved by saying the words. And then, you know, they give you this little flag to wave.
Yes.
Which you have to hold while you're doing it. So I still have the little flag because it felt like an important part of the event, you know. And
where is it? Where's your
it's
flag?
It's in my workroom, you know, stuck between two books. And then I came out into the daylight and got a cab to go home. In this city where I'd lived for by then 18 years or something, and everything felt different. Uh-huh. I just thought, I was quite shocked that it was had that very powerful effect. But I thought, oh, this is different, you know.
So are you American? Are you an American novelist now?
I am technically an American novelist now. Yes, exactly. And this is, yeah, that's different too.
There's a line from your novel, America's Secret Identity wasn't a superhero. Turns out it was a super villain.
For the moment, anyway. You know.
Is that how it feels for the moment?
It's beginning to, yeah. I think there's a dark side that is in the ascendant. You know, I don't believe in things being irreversible, however. You know, I think there's a certain amount of willingness to believe that this is the new normal, you know, and I'm not sure that that's the case. I think that other America, the one that was in the ascendant for 8 years immediately previously, mm-hmm. hasn't gone anywhere, you know, and in many ways that younger generation growing up is very idealistic and progressive in its thinking, and this may be, you know, white supremacism's last stand. I don't know. But, I mean, I don't know. Despair is lazy. It's unfashioned. It's you know, we can't afford it.
So what do you do instead?
Well, argue back, fight back, keep going.
Do you yell at your television?
You know, I can't. I have to say, I can't stand his voice. So I have to mute the television. I can read afterwards what's been said and etc., but the actual voice, no thank you. And, you know, there's a wonderful saying of the old Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci. He said that what you should have is pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will. So even if you can see intellectually that these are difficult times, you have to have the will to change them.
Perfect place to end our discussion. Salman Rushdie, thank you so much for joining us today once again on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And his novel is called The Golden House. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Diana Martinez, the engineer for the show. And the show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And we do want to close things out, actually. We dug through the internet once again, and we found The Ground Beneath Her Feet. This is a U2, based on the lyrics of Salman Rushdie. It goes back to a 2000 album. And it's a ballad that Bono wrote after reading Rushdie's 1999 novel titled The Ground Beneath Her Feet. And the lyrics are almost verbatim from a portion of the book, so Rushdie got the songwriting credit.